It's kind of surprising because I traveled a lot when I was a racer 25 years ago. And now when I travel, I go to these small cities or little corners of the United States, and I see all kinds of people riding bikes. So we're in the middle of a big experiment, and things are changing.
Well, recognize that voice? That's my guest, Bob Mionski. Bob's an attorney in Portland, Oregon, frequent guest on the show. And we cover the waterfront today in our little discussion of all things bicycle, bicycling and the law. It's Bob's book. Touch on that and many other subjects in the next 30 minutes. Thanks so much for joining me. I'm your host, Frank Peters, and this is my show, CDM Cyclist. Well, Bob's got, of course, a broad perspective on cycling. As he mentioned, he's a former racer, today an attorney, an author. He publishes articles every month in Bicycling Magazine. He's got a great perspective on what's going on. And of course, he lives in Portland, Oregon. Portland, a platinum city, really on the leading edge, no two ways about it, bicycle advocacy in this country. So we have a lot to talk about today.
Bob, thanks so much for joining me. Let's get started.
Bob Mionski, author of Bicycling and the Law. Bob, you also write for Bicycling Magazine. How long have you been doing that?
I think about 5 years. And before that, I wrote for another magazine for about 7 or 8 years. So I've been doing it a while.
Mm-hmm. As I anticipated talking to you again, I was a little jealous, a pang of jealousy, in that when you're talking about bicycling and the law, there's almost like never-ending material. Am I right?
Yeah, it goes on and on.
It does, yeah. A lifetime employment for you, Bob, huh?
Yeah, but, you know, life doesn't last forever.
Yeah, yeah. Now, many times, of course, is it too negative of me to say that when it comes to bicycling and the law, there are too many sad stories? Are there? How about a positive? Can you think of something, bicycling and the law?
Well, I think one thing, if you travel around the United States, especially if you come from a place where there's a lot of cycling infrastructure and a lot of cyclists, it's kind of surprising because I traveled a lot when I was a racer 25 years ago. And now when I travel, I go to these small cities or little corners of the United States, and I see all kinds of people riding bikes. So we're in the middle of a big experiment, and things are changing.
Yes. You know, down here in Southern California, see a lot of good press lately. I think in part it's because Los Angeles is doing so much. It attracts a lot of, you know, writers, press. That encourages a lot of advocates, you know, in some of the smaller cities in the Southland here. Anyway, so it's a trend that keeps on going, doesn't it?
Well, as you know firsthand, it's an addictive, sport and pastime, and then there's all those other advantages that we know about cycling. So,
yeah, all that health and all of that. Now, I read an article just, it's probably 3 weeks ago now. Somebody was saying that the reason why we find cycling so enjoyable is that it's our fight or flight mechanism. That when you're riding the bicycle, you are making, you know, split second fight or flight. Do I go over that rock, around it, that stone, that pothole? There's a car in the driveway, all of those things. And we get to burn off that fight or flight, those hormones or that chemistry going on. You ever heard that? Is that crazy?
I've never heard it postulated, but I concur 100%.
Yeah.
Think about how many people play virtual reality games. So
same kind of thing, yeah.
It's in our nature, and like a lot of things, modern conveniences take us away from who we were or who we are. And when we fulfill those more primitive urges, I think we're satisfied. It's sort of the notion behind exercise.
Yes, isn't it? Yeah, we have become very sedentary. Oh, Bob, I made a note now, anticipating talking to you. I don't know if I ever thanked you for the mirrors. You sent me a set of bar-end mirrors, because we were talking about mirrors previously. So thank you for that.
Absolutely. What's your experience been?
Oh, I have. John Ciccarelli is, he's a bicycle advocate in San Francisco, formerly from Stanford. I showed up to interview him one day, and he's wearing a mirror on his bike glasses. And ever since then, I have been wearing a mirror on my bike glasses. What I like about that is I've got several bikes, so no matter which bike I jump on, I've got a mirror that I'm comfortable with, and I know how to, turn my head perfectly.
I understand. So you were already using a mirror when I sent you those.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Just a different option.
The challenge I had was I've been collecting bikes, so then it's just one more thing to fit a mirror on a bike. And anyway, the eyeglass version simplifies that.
Well, unfortunately, I have perfect vision, so unless I'm wearing sunglasses, I'd have to do something else at the evening.
Oh, and you don't wear sunglasses, Bob?
I do, but it's not always sunglass weather here in mm-hmm. Portland, Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
Including today.
Now, speaking of that, I just did a little tour. Now we've got some substantive issues we're going to get into in just a minute. We'll keep our audience in suspense. But I just prepared for an 8-day visit to Halifax, Nova Scotia, and. I'm watching the weather every day as I, pack my bag. And I know it's not unreasonable to expect rain. Now, I didn't get, I don't think, a single drop. But it reminds me of eyewear is an issue when it's raining. How do you handle that, Bob? You get lots of practice at that.
I have a pair of clear glasses.
Clear.
I used to, that's one of the more difficult things you can encounter when you're a bicycle racing. And as you can imagine, in a bicycle race, there's a lot of water flying up from the road, and nobody uses fenders. And if you've ever followed another cyclist that's riding on really wet roadway, especially if it has standing water on it, that will come up off the back wheel in a stream not dissimilar to a hose, and you're over the handlebars and it's hitting you right in the face. So I always wore a pair of clear glasses, but if you look at the photos of the professional peloton in Europe, most of the riders just go without anything. And if you see them interviewed at the end, their eyes are very red.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hard on your body.
Yeah. Well, Bob, as we get to work now, checking out some of your blogs, you've been talking about 3-foot rules lately and the 3-foot passing rule. Now, we're all excited here in California. Governor Brown vetoed it last year, but it's coming back at him real soon, I guess. The Senate passed it. It's still got a ways to go before it gets to his desk. Tie that back into my trip to Halifax. They had just, like in the 6 months prior, they have I call it a 1-meter rule, which doesn't sound as big, but it's equivalent, of course. And I was greatly pleased to see how widely that was, compliance was excellent in Nova Scotia with their 1-meter rule. What have you been writing about 3-foot rules, Bob?
Well, there's a lot of jurisdictions looking into it, and it's being adopted by different states. And there are various arguments about whether or not it's a good idea, whether or not it works, whether or not it can be enforced. And they're legitimate concerns. We find that from an anecdotal perspective that it's very rare for the police department to issue tickets for violation of the 3-foot rule. And there's some practical reasons for that, and I think there's some social and political reasons as well. But it still has some value no matter whether or not it's enforced, believe it or not, because much like Sharrow's, it's notification to the public. And so, of course, the important component is education when it comes to the 3-foot rule, letting the public know.
Right. That's it in a nutshell, isn't it? Yeah. I've often thought in kind of like the worst possible situation, if somebody gets hit by a car, I mean, that basically proves that he was not obliging the 3-foot law, the motorist.
You would think so, but there's an inherent defense in that scenario, and that is, was a cyclist traveling in a straight line, or, and of course, a cyclist isn't always required to do so, but there's a defense by the driver that mm-hmm. the cyclist swerved over in front of them. And then unfortunately, if the cyclist has been incapacitated, they can't always defend or rebut those arguments. So right. we find there's a number of cases, and this is something I have written about, where cyclists are hit from behind and no ticket is issued
mm-hmm.
for the 3-foot violation. So we got a ways to go on that. It's not a perfect solution, but it's a good start.
Like you hinted at earlier, there are cultural reasons why too. Is it kind of, it's just not, hasn't risen to a level where, say, law enforcement is, feeling that strongly about it? Is that?
That's my feeling yeah. about yeah. their feeling is that you can put the rule out there, but there's a lot of discretion until we have more of a consensus about in all corners of the country about what cyclists have in the way of right and what they bring to the mm-hmm. transportation system. So, but we're moving in the right direction. There's no yeah. doubt about that.
No doubt about that. Now it makes me think of parallels. I don't know if it's true or not with like. Lots of distracted driving laws on the books, even here in California. But law enforcement's not going to stop somebody for driving around, obviously talking on the phone, unless they see him doing some other violation, too. So that's kind of a cultural aspect of it, too, deeming it not worthy of a stop and ticket, I guess.
We just had a sort of an addendum added to our rules in terms of using telephones when you're in automobiles. And there was a kind of a loophole here in Oregon and everyone was using it. And the loophole essentially said you can't use your cell phone when you're driving unless you need it for your job. And what they meant by that was some people use a cell phone instead of a dispatch radio. So some truckers, some taxi drivers, professional drivers, essentially, there was an exception written into the law, but people being as creative as they are decided, well, I need my phone for my job, and so therefore I fit within the exception. So they clarified that in the hopes that, the message would get out to the public, but I can tell you that it hasn't entirely, and that people are driving around talking on their cell phones in great numbers here in Oregon, and I don't know what the police position on that is. It irritates me greatly because it's often that driver that turns because they don't have a free hand to signal, and they turn and violate the rights of pedestrians and cyclists and other drivers when they're talking on the phone.
Mm-hmm. I'm on the Newport Beach Bike Safety Committee, and people from the police department attending all the time. And I just remember one comment. I can't remember who said it, but when I asked him if he rode a bike himself, he talked about all the distracted driving that he observes out there when he's on his motorcycle. And, I'll bet that's discouraging to see all of that.
Well, it lets you get your fight or flight
yes,
levels up quicker, doesn't it?
Yeah, it sure does. Yeah. Now, moving towards, this is all, I guess, what drives people in my neighborhood onto riding their bikes onto the sidewalk, which is one of the things I wanted to talk to you about today, Bob. We've got Sharrows coming to a stretch of Pacific Coast Highway here in Newport Beach, California, a little part of town called Corona del Mar, and it's something we've been working on for, almost 3 years now. And we've got the political will behind it now. It's all just implementation and when. Probably won't happen during the summer because traffic and all of that. There's, it's easier to do infrastructure changes off-season here. Too many people trying to come to the beach. But I kind of jumped ahead, and I know a lot of people in the community here, they think about Sharrows. They might be nervous about it. Of course, many merchants here, too, wondering if it's going to slow traffic or drive people crazy. And I've thought about trying to tie some kind of a campaign about riding on the sidewalk with the implementation of the new Sharrows. They kind of might make sense, huh, if we make riding on the streets safer, lure more people out.
I think so. I mean, definitely the statistics bear out that bike lanes will increase and grow the cycling population. And I haven't seen evidence of the sharrows doing that, but I do think it's commonsensical that if I look out onto the roadway and I see that the road is marked for cycling and I see a cyclist go by, that could draw me off the sidewalk personally. So if I had made that choice, I think anecdotally it's going to work. Maybe you'll be the test case that other jurisdictions look to. If you get up to speed before it's implemented, I think maybe you'll have a chance to help other communities.
That's one of the big benefits of this. Now, a little bit of background. Caltrans, you know, Department of Transportation, trying to divest itself of Pacific Coast Highway. You know, they want to work on, you know, big interstate freeways. So Corona Del Mar, Newport Beach bought this 1.1-mile stretch of Coast Highway a few years ago. Now, I think at the time they thought they wanted to have it so they could, you know, beautify it, plant some nice flowers in the median, all of that. So anyway, today, as we become more cycling savvy, we see opportunities to, you know, create this kind of infrastructure. And of course, one of the big benefits is not everybody who rides on Coast Highway lives in the neighborhood. They're, you know, we're a corridor all the way down the coast. I keep thinking people in Laguna Beach and South County motorists will observe this change and they'll reflect on it. And perhaps they'll take a little bit of that awareness with them as they drive around cyclists in their own neighborhood.
Well, you know, the whole notion behind critical mass would support mm-hmm. your idea. Mm-hmm. The critical mass being not the cycling organization or affiliation, but the idea that when you get a sufficient amount of adopters to a new way, then into a social system, essentially, then it becomes self-sustaining and creates further growth. So. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If you look out onto the that little stretch you have in Corona Del Mar, and you see people safely riding along, that's going to bring more people off the sidewalk. I'm certain that will happen.
Yeah, people often have described that like critical mass phenomenon as it relates to reducing what I often call bad bicyclist behavior, too. I've heard it said many times, Bob, that, you know, running stop signs and stop lights and other bad behavior on cyclists tends to dampen down as you get more cyclists out. There's a conformity, the social aspect of cycling. You've read that, too?
I have not read that, but that's really my area of interest. You know, the bandwagon effect, mm-hmm. if you will. You know, the probability of any individual adapting and adopting the rule or the new social norm increases when more people do it, at least up to about a third. Right. That's the one-third rule. I mean, human sociology is my favorite subject, and it's tightly wound with almost everything in cycling.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I can picture that. Now, when it comes to riding bikes on the sidewalk, most cities just make that against the law and think they're done with it, right?
I don't know if most cities have that rule, but certainly big cities have areas where they don't allow it. Here in Portland, we have a quadrant of the most congested area downtown where sidewalk riding is prohibited. And then, so for instance, maybe up to 15 blocks in any direction from the center of downtown, you're not allowed on the sidewalk. I see people doing it occasionally. Some people do it, you know, with 1 foot off, or they're just getting down the block, and that seems to be tolerated. But commuting by sidewalk is crazy because you're riding right by doorways, children, elderly people, people that need all of the sidewalk are going to be infringed by your route. It's just a crazy thing to do. On the other hand, as you pointed out to me, some people would argue that it's crazy in certain sections of road to be out there on your bike. And for their own survival, they choose the sidewalk. That's the rub.
I often think it's fear. That's what I observe. Well, like when you take Coast Highway here, Without Sharrows today and without a bike lane, that's some serious traffic moving through town. Probably the irony is that it's moving quite slowly, but it looks massive. It doesn't encourage bicycle riding.
Well, there was a study done here in Portland that talked about the different levels of concern and the different kinds of riders and how they face those, the environment. And what they found was less than 1% was categorized as strong and fearless. And that's kind of what you're talking about. That's the kind of rider that will ride no matter what facility is provided. And then about 6% of the population falls into the enthusiastic and competent category, as they named it. And these individuals will ride if some facilities are provided. But the big bulk, the big chunk of people fall into the interested but concerned category. Mm-hmm. And for these individuals, and that's about 60% of the population, according to the study, and these individuals is what we're looking at when we add bike lanes and when we add sharrows, because we're seeing that these kinds of riders, if there's something added to their comfort level, they will move out into the street. And that's where the real cycling growth will be found.
If they see other people on the street, they see traffic. Yeah, and the street's marked, and they see traffic conforming to the new guidelines.
Right. Sure. Any kind of facility. I mean, the way this study wasn't specific, but I think what they're saying is that if they look out and they see a share row marking, if they see a bike lane, if they see a bike light, which we've had several installed in Portland in the last year, then we're going to tap into that 60%, which is really where the growth is going to be found. The strong and fearless is just such a small percentage. And the enthusiastic and competent are probably out if you have facilities already. So the next jump is bike lanes and sharrows. Now, some people don't like bike lanes. You know, we have a split.
Yeah.
There's the vehicular cyclist angle, which is, I think, a show in itself, that feel that sharrows are great and bike lanes, there's no reason to add them, that it's a bad thing.
Expand on that, Bob, a little bit. The vehicular cyclists, we've got people down here, of course, advocating that too. Their basic theory is they're going to just ride out there with every other vehicle. They don't need any special infrastructure.
Right. That's the idea, is that separate facilities are dangerous. They'll point out that when you're in a bike lane that you face significant threat from lateral moving vehicles, from turning vehicles, that essentially there's a false sense of safety that comes along with being in a bike lane. Oh, I'm in the bike lane. I'm good to go. You won't make that mistake when you're in a regular road.
Yeah, when you're out there in traffic with everybody else, right?
Right. So, and there are different kinds of bike lanes, of course. There are the ones that are just painted right along the regular lane of traffic. And then there are those that are separated by, a little sidewalk or a curb or something. And, that's where a lot of the growth and infrastructure has been. These kinds of bike facilities are going in all over the United States. And much to the chagrin of the vehicular cyclist, who believes that the best thing for cycling in America is for cyclists to learn how to operate their bicycle like you operate an automobile. Mm-hmm. This is clearly the case for the strong, fearless, the one and less than 1%.
Right.
It could extend into that 6%, but cracking the 60%, and the rest, that's a tough sell in my book.
I saw a video about city planning in Paris a little while ago, and the latest theory there maybe I don't know how old the video was. Now they're moving back to the concept of, I guess you'd say, vehicular. Everybody in the roadway, no separate space for anybody. And when I saw that, my first thought was, wow, we're doing it the wrong way here. But then I thought about their evolution, how they got to that point, And perhaps we have to start with, some separate facilities, bike lanes, to get people out there and to educate our motorists and create safer conditions, and then move towards more sharing the roadway. I don't know.
Well, that's not a bad way to look at it. You know, I should add that one of the other concerns of the vehicular cyclist is that once we allow the government to tell us where we can ride our bike, they're also telling us where we can't ride our bike, and that on that slippery slope, we will continue to move towards less and less rights and abilities to ride our bikes to where we want to go. And I don't think that's an irrational thought, but it doesn't completely contemplate the reality of a auto-centric society,
right,
that we are, and the change that we're making. You know, and clearly riding on a bike, there's bike lanes, and of course there are bike paths, and bike paths are completely separated from the vehicular motorized traffic, but they're not completely safe either. You have rollerbladers, joggers, and cyclists riding in both directions. And actually, in my office, I've had a significant increase of inquiries and calls about cycling on cycling injury.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to be a growing problem.
Any common? Why is that growing, Bob? Is there a sense of less awareness of the cyclists when they're out in a what they perceive a safer environment? Do they take their eye off the ball, kind of?
I think that's what it is, Frank. You know, if you look at a bike lane, it in some cases, especially around turns, and if there's any kind of undulating terrain, it's not that easy to keep your bike on a straight line like
right.
that. And if you come around a corner a little too fast and you drift into the other side, that's a head-on collision. And a 200-pound man going 25, 30 miles an hour running into a small person could be deadly, and it has been.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to sharing the roadway, the shared lane markings that we're about to implement here. One of the challenges we've faced is here in Orange County, we've got a regional agency, the OCTA. Many people think of it as the bus company, but they're a lot more than the bus company, right? They're responsible for the buses and public transportation, but also there's this collective mentality of maintaining certain levels of service. So the idea is you can't take one city, they can't do something to their roadways that would, you know, make it difficult for through traffic to, you know, travel through their city on those roadways to get to their, you know, hometown. This business of levels of service. You know what I'm talking about, Bob?
Of course.
Yeah, yeah. So one of the things I keep thinking is we've got to kind of address that head on, this levels of service. It reinforces the whole automobile-centric mentality, doesn't it? Isn't that where we start?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have a lot of personal experience with that organization and with
sure.
that tension
oh,
that it
sure.
creates. But anytime you're changing things, you're going to find that there's some resistance, and some of the resistance might be institutionalized. And just because it's institutionalized doesn't mean it's right. You know, sometimes a higher view is necessary, but the different parts of the machine are not adapted to do that. They're adapted to do what they were intended to do in the first place, and they just keep on chugging away. So without making a comment about,
sure.
You know, who's right or wrong in that situation, I would suggest that just because they hold those levels of service standards doesn't mean that that's the proper approach.
Right. It is. You hit the nail on the head there, Bob. It's just institutionalized. Yeah. Yeah. Well, Bob, I've got a question for you. I thought you could rate me on just a few days ago, and I wasn't expecting it. A neighbor friend of mine, he's not a cyclist, and I would venture to say he's skeptical of the whole cycling movement, too. He asked me my opinion about bicycle licensing, and I hadn't rehearsed my answer in quite a little while there. Bicycle licensing, many jurisdictions think about licensing cyclists, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and what was my response? I guess maybe it's because I grew up during the Nixon administration. I think of the government grants you a license in part so they feel like they can take it away from you at some point. That was part of my argument why I wasn't in favor of licensing. But how about your perspective? What are your thoughts on bicycle licensing? Is it a good idea? It's not possible. It's not popular with a lot of cyclists, is it?
You're referring to the requirement to have an operator's license, or or having tags on your vehicle licensing.
Well, I hadn't thought of tags on your bike.
A lot of times that's what's being proposed.
Oh yeah.
You know, to catch scofflaw cyclists. And one of the problems with that, of course, is how big of a plate do you need to be able to identify the person, right? Mm-hmm. So, but you're talking about having a license to ride, I think. And there's a couple of issues that come up when you discuss this. And one of them is our Constitution talks about our right and our ability to have freedom of travel. And when you're driving a motorized vehicle, you have to get a license, as you know, and so it's a privilege. It's a privilege that the government gives you. Okay, you've tested out. Here are the rules, and provisionally we're going to give you this license you can carry, and now you can operate a vehicle. We don't do that with bicycles, and I think for a good reason. And we don't do it for joggers, and we don't do it for walkers.
Right.
And I think, for me, the heart of it, and it's what I wrote about in my book, was that constitutionally speaking, this is a fundamental freedom that allows all our other freedoms to be empowered. The right for people to congress and to move. And if you start creating a requirement for licensing, you're going to infringe upon that. Now, from a practical standpoint, how do you license a cyclist? Who's going to pay for it? Who's going to administer the program? You'd have to charge over $100, maybe $200 annually to be able to even pay for the administration of bicycle licensing. What do you do with children? What do you do with a person that has an old Schwinn in their garage that just wants to go out for a ride, you know, when it's pleasant out on a June morning? They have to take the time and money to get a license, or they have to decide not to ride, or they have to break the law. So I'm against it, and I think you hit it on the head yourself when you said that they give you a right, so they might potentially take it away.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I'm going to give you an 8 out of 10 on this.
Oh, an 8. All right, that's like a B plus. Yeah, that's pretty good. Well, Bob, it's nice to have you back on the show. And my guest today, Bob Mionski, author of Bicycling and the Law. Thanks again, Bob.
Well, thanks for having me, Frank. I look forward to talking to you soon, and hope you have some good rides.
All right, thanks. Same to you, Bob. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, we're back in the studio, and couldn't you just listen to Bob all day long, huh? He's got a smooth style and great perspective. Appreciate having him on the show. Thanks, Bob. Well, Bob would love to hear from you. Why don't you come by the website, cdmcyclist.com. Leave a comment behind. While you're on the website, you'll notice that you can subscribe to the show through iTunes. Connect your iPod, iPad, or iPhone. Every time there's a new episode of the show, automatically download into your portable device. Check that out, please. While you're checking things out, how about a visit to bikenewportbeach.org, where myself and several other bicycle advocates around town here in Newport Beach, California, we write about the issues. We have a vigorous bike safety committee. It was called a task force 3 years ago, but it's meeting pretty much, you know, continuously for 3 years now. A lot of great things happening in Newport Beach, working its way into a real leadership role in terms of, you know, creating safer streets for cyclists in Orange County, California. Check it out, please. BikeNewportBeach.org. Well, that's it for today's show. Thanks so much for joining me and Bob Mionski. Until next time, get out there and get on that bike. Feel like a kid again.